Hello and welcome to the Fremantle Shipping News. It's great to be here and welcome to View from the Roundhouse. This is our second last pod before the federal election, which will be the focal point for today as per our campaign period. And this time round, I've got with me a familiar voice and a familiar face for some of you, William Bowe, the AKA the Pole Bludger. An old chum of mine who've been around the traps a few times. We seem to keep popping up in the same places. And William, I think for those of you less familiar with William's work, his Pole Bludger site is one of the best places to go for consistent and ongoing pole analysis, but also his election guides, which are very, very extensive. And more recently, William, you've had a fairly significant hand in Channel 9's election coverage.
Yes, I'm off to Sydney to that end next week. I do sort of data work, so you're not going to see my photogenic features on television, I don't think. But yes, I do a lot of the work that enables projections to be made, results to be predicted, and God willing, the result to be called 60 seconds before Anthony Green does it.
Well, we might ask you for your crystal ball prediction at the end of this conversation, William. So
Oh, I
there's
don't like
a
your chances,
warning.
but you may get my guard down. See how you go.
We'll see how we go.
Yeah.
Well, it's been an interesting week as usual. Every week's been a little bit different in this election campaign. This week, early voting started. We might touch on that really briefly, William. What difference? The AEC is calculated this time around. I think they're probably likely to be on the money that around about 50% of all votes will be counted, will be cast, I should say, early, well before polling day. And polling, early voting has started already, started on Tuesday of this week. What difference does the high incidence of early voting make to the different campaigns?
Well, I think a feature of this campaign is that the answer to that question is not enough difference. And in particular, the coalition don't seem to have had a grand strategy to, deal with the reality of the fact that, if you haven't got your cards on the table by several weeks in advance of what we now laughably call election day, then you clearly haven't planned properly. And yet we saw in the course of this week, a policy of massive importance announced in relation to defence by the coalition relative to what the rest of their, suite of election policies look like, which is real sort of small target tinkering and very little big picture to the coalition campaign up to this point. And now they've come up with something that could have been a structuring factor around their entire campaign. They've just done it too late. And other things they were doing too late, other aspects of their policies, they weren't announcing until well into the campaign. And I think that this is because a lot of their strategizing has been quite ad hoc. And they have been complacent about the fact that they've felt that Labor's negatives will win it for them. And as the polls turned against them and they realised it wasn't so, they look like they've been reacting and they've been doing it too late. So that's probably a far too specific answer to the question that you asked, which was, about how modern campaigns change. Like, but, to answer that question more generally, we see, for usually important campaign announcements are made in the lead up to the campaign and the early period of it. And it's less than like campaigns used to be in the distant past when, parties had an election manifesto that was, announced at a campaign launch. And here's our suite of policies that we will have a mandate to implement if we win. I think that the whole election and political process is less sort of focused in that sort of way than it used to be.
I think that's an interesting point you made, particularly about the defence announcement this week. Why would you go out and announce big spending policies once voting's already started? For me, it just doesn't make any sense. But it does show that perhaps the coalition's campaign simply hasn't been as well organised as it should be, and they've spent a lot of time reacting to things
And but
going on.
it's a strange point of policy to be reactive on. I can imagine a party panicking because one of their policies isn't going down well, which we absolutely did see in relation to the coalition with regard to work from home. And again, today they've re-engineered their policy on public service cuts. These are the sorts of ad hoc kind of policies I might expect to see from a party that's adjusting to the fact that their policies or their strategies have backfired. I don't expect a sweeping new policy about our the entire strategic direction of our defense policy. It's not the sort of thing that you expect to see a cobbled together ad hoc midway during an election campaign. Surely they planned to do this a long time ago. Why they would make that announcement after voting has already started, there must be an answer to that question. I would be fascinated to know what it is.
What we do expect to see very late in the base volume, I think, and this is where early voting is an interesting process, is the costings for election policies to come through. And we still are waiting on some of those details from the coalition and some of the other parties. I think that this happens to every single opposition party that I've seen for election after election, is that a couple of days before the poll, they announce their costings. And there's always a controversy over them. And a lot of people already voted. So I think that's a bit of a shame with the timing of that. But I'm not surprised.
Well, it is, it's like clockwork. I'm sure that happened during the state election campaign. I think the sort of Thursday they were coming out with their costings. And I'm not sure to what extent that is something to do with the early voting phenomenon. I think this is something you were sort of seeing in the 2000s before that phenomenon fully kicked in. But yes, oppositions are very keen to, leave those difficult things until it's too late for it to blow up in their face, or if it does to blow up in their face, to have the general public notice that it's happened.
Well, the other thing we did see this week was the final of the three debates, William, this time on Channel 9. And this was, a stand and deliver one. It had a panel of a few journalists and a moderator from Nine. Do you think it changed any votes?
No, I don't, and I can't remember in the Australian context the last time a debate really did make any tangible degree of difference. We absolutely saw it in a US presidential debate last year. I think that's the scale of what needs to happen for the dial to move. You have a performance that is as that exposes the fact that one of the candidates is past being competent for the job. Clearly, whatever else you might say of them, neither Anthony Albanese or Peter Dutton are in that position. So I think each of them gave, boringly workmanlike performances in each of the three debates. Each of them used every question as an opportunity to reel off the laundry list of their set piece campaign policies. And if that's all you're doing, you can't really go wrong. Both candidates are, presenting a small target. They know what their lines are. And at the end of the debate, it's very difficult to perceive, that one side did better than the other because it's all so rehearsed. And, as a result, I don't think they rate very well these days. And, there needs to be a really sort of major failure. I don't think you can win a debate in a positive sense. You can lose a debate if you fumble, if you stuff up, if you say something that completely contradicts some other thing you've said. But as I say, in the context of Australian debates, They just seem too well rehearsed for that to happen, and they never seem to be of much consequence. I could come up with a kind of half-baked opinion of who I thought won for at least some of the debates, but I wouldn't disagree with the opinion of anyone who said otherwise. It's invariably a very marginal points decision.
The other point I'd make too, well, you miss it, whilst none of them exactly put a foot wrong, when you're just rehearsing your existing policy settings, you're not really making ground either, are you? You're not really shifting anything. So both
Yeah,
Albanese
and
and Dutton, they work their well-rehearsed lines, they're workmanlike. I don't think they actually won anyone extra to their cause. I think that's
yeah,
the problem.
well, and I mean, if, as you say, there is that level of rehearsal, and it makes sense if you're in front, that you want to, have this debate be quickly forgotten and for the status quo to immediately return after the debate is over when you are ahead. That's not the position that Peter Dutton is in, though. So maybe you would have thought that he wouldn't be as sort of robotic as he has been during these debates. He did cop a little bit of flack for kind of flaring up a little bit at Albanese during an early part of the most recent debate. His line about not being able to lie straight in bed at night. I think that I recall like J Tony Abbott coming up with his "Does this guy ever shut up?" line in 2013 against Kevin Rudd. That was clearly also well rehearsed in its way, but it was sort of risky and out of the box, and it wasn't just another boring campaign moment. Colin Barnett used a debate as the platform to make his famous canal announcement in 2005. That was an example of someone who knows they're drifting towards the defeat trying to use the debate as an opportunity. Not for this, not just to be another boring, here's, the fuel rebate, income tax, tiny little policies that they were kept going on about in these debates. We didn't see Peter Dutton do that. Maybe what he might have done at the beginning of this debate was throw the grenade in there that we're going to increase defence spending by, to 3% of GDP by 2035, just like Trump is demanding of us. And that would have, pulled the rug from underneath the whole debate, and we'd have something to talk about. But, as it is, he didn't do that. He kind of, just made yet another election campaign announcement that looked like all the others, except this time he's, announcing something dramatic.
I'm just going to change tack a little bit, William. A little bit of a one from left field a bit here. Of course, we all know on Easter Monday the Pope died, and it's dominated headlines left, right, and centre. Does that make it a little bit harder if you're behind to make ground? I think both campaigns said that they were dialing back for a day or two on afterwards out of respect, etc. They darkened the doors of various churches in response, etc. Do you think it had any impact on the campaign? What's your assessment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was transformative, but there were a couple of days there where Peter Dutton really would have liked to have cut through in the news, where that became very difficult to do. And I don't think that should be overstated. I think that in any election campaign, there's going to be, big stories like that. This is, at the higher end of that scale. But it's not going to dominate the headlines day in, day out for longer than a couple of days. But it happened at a time when, we knew there was going to be this period in the middle of campaign where Easter was going to interrupt everything. And I think the feeling was that it was a bit of a phony war before that. And it was only after that Easter break that, first, well, voting begins at that point, but I think things were always going to sort of pitch up in terms of the amount of advertising that was going to appear in broadcast media. And right at that moment, the amount of news space available to the election shrinks in an unexpected way. So, yeah, you have to say that that is favourable to whoever is in front. And unexpectedly, because I mean, when I say that it was realized in advance, a month or two ago, that this was how the campaign was going to play out. What we didn't realize at that point was that Labor were going to be in the commanding position they seem to be in at the moment. If you'd told me this, in advance that this was what was going to happen during the campaign, I might have said, "Oh, well, that's going to be bad news for Labor because Labor are floundering and they're going to need to come home strong with some sort of scare campaign like they famously did in 2016." Or a couple of other occasions, and they're going to lose that oxygen. But we've ended up observing a very different election campaign than I think what most of us expected. And it's Peter Dutton who needs all the clean air that he can get, and he's been deprived of some of it.
Yeah, that'd be my assessment too, that it was just a couple of days when the opportunity to cut through just wasn't there. It can arise for a variety of reasons. Of course, we've got Anzac Day. This is being recorded on Thursday night. We've got Anzac Day coming up and those sorts of things. That again probably shifts the attention and the gaze for a couple of days. And really, whoever's behind, you're starting to run out of days now. We're talking about a week, just a touch over a week from the main polling day. So, anyway.
You could argue, though, that Anzac Day is a useful bit of mood music from Peter Dutton's perspective. It sort of reinforces the salience of kind of a positive sense of patriotism. And this plays well towards the kind of coalition outlook on the world. And I think if Peter Dutton can, it won't amount to much, but the sort of solemnity of the dawn service, we will undoubtedly see the politicians at these services tomorrow. But I think that's crowded out by the fact that people just aren't going to be watching the news. They're not going to be paying attention, and a lot of this is going to be missed.
Let's move on a little bit to some of the broader chances of the different parties at this stage. Just a bit out from a week before the polling day. What would you say is the other chances? Let's start with, say, the Greens and Independents, and how many seats you think they'll win or retain next week.
I think that for the Greens, the game for them is probably holding their ground. They could win the seat of Wills in Melbourne off Labor, but that they had a absolutely unprecedented result in 2022. So you can't expect them to break that much ground at every election. So they won three seats in Brisbane, which I would never have thought was going to be where the Greens would break through. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, at a future election in a decade or so, the Greens are going to win four seats, and I'll say, yeah, I can believe that. Where do you think those seats will be? I wouldn't have said three seats in Brisbane, but that was where it happened. And it was a kind of high watermark for them. That can't see them ever winning further seats than those three in Brisbane. So they are absolutely on the defensive in Brisbane against both parties. Those three seats are all seats where Labor, the Coalition, and the Greens have substantial shares of the vote. Brisbane, in particular, is a seat that any of those three parties could win. And as well as that, you've got Ryan, which is a seat that normally leans towards the coalition. You've got Griffith, which is a seat that normally leans towards Labor. So there are all three of them are really complex three-way races. I think the general view is that the Greens will probably hold Griffith. I would not have picked them to win Ryan at the start of the campaign, but the weakening of the coalition since then makes me think that they've still got a shot. I think Labor more likely than not will win Brisbane off the Greens. So I think the best case scenario for the Greens is five seats, but I think four, one of them is very unlikely. I think if they maintain the status quo, it will be by winning Wills but losing Brisbane. And as well as that, there are other scenarios where they, worst case scenario is they lose all three of those Brisbane seats. That's not impossible. But I think realistically, we're looking at 2 to 4 seats for the Greens compared with the 4 they won last time.
I think there's a fairly good assessment, despite the fact that we should be tracking the Greens based on their primary vote. I think that that tells us more about how well they're going. I think the harsh reality is their election campaign will be judged principally on how many of those 3 seats in Brisbane they can retain. I think that's what politics is. It's about how
Well,
many
but I
seats you win.
mean, as well as that, very likely they are going to win Senate seats in every state. Not definitely, but like legalized cannabis had a bit of a surge in 2022, and they didn't win anything, but in a couple of places they threatened to. If that's part of an ongoing trend, then maybe that's a kind of new predator to the left that the Greens face. But I do think the most likely outcome for the Greens is that they do win. They retain the 6 Senate seats they're defending. And you'd have to say that while there will be the focus on the House of Representatives, the Senate is really where they get things done. And if they are in a more or less permanent position of holding 12 seats in the Senate, then, even if at worst this election will be a bit of a road bump for them. They're clearly, a very entrenched part of our landscape now.
Oh, look, they're not going away anywhere soon. What about the Teals? What's their chances of sticking around for the ones that were elected last time? And where are the opportunities for them to pick up? I'm trying not to treat them as an individual, as a party. They're individuals, William. But how do you think the Teal independents will fare?
I have to make the disclosure here that I do a little bit of, I have a bit of a side hustle doing a bit of consultancy work with Climate 200. So apologies in advance if you think this sounds self-interested. But it's really hard to call genuinely because a lot of these races are really close. If they get a bit of wind to their sails, they could have a brilliant night. If and they, the independent phenomenon could have a brilliant night. On the other hand, with a bit of bad luck, they could be reduced. But I certainly think they're still going to be a presence. I could name a number of seats which I'm pretty certain are going to hold. And there are new opportunities for them, which again may or may not come through. We are looking at a lot of very close results here. I think that there are probably 2 Teals who are safe. The rest of them, they're all competitive. I wouldn't say with any confidence that any of them are going to lose, but all of the incumbents could well be back. Quite a few of them could lose. And as well as that, there are a couple of seats that are on the table. Bradfield in Sydney is the best shot. That has taken over a lot of the abolished seat of North Sydney, which was a Teal win in 2022. And slightly surprisingly, you may think, given that to this point, the Teal independent phenomenon has been a phenomenon of the affluent suburbs of the big cities. There are a couple of regional seats where Teal candidates broadly defined are certainly competitive. And I would say that the two main ones of those are Wannon in Western Victoria and Cowper in the mid-north coast region of New South Wales. They are very willing campaigns going on there. The Liberals in the former case, the Nationals in the latter, clearly know that they have a big challenge. They're campaigning very hard there. And you have to throw that into the very large mix of seats involving Teals, which all you can say is that it's close. And we really won't know until the night which way they blow. It's not like the major parties that they've got entrenched safe seats. And every Teal, every independent, I think every election is going to be a battle for them.
There's a few seats to watch there. I think the interesting point about both Wannon and Cowper, the independent Wannon's been running a number of electoral cycles, so he's got some profile,
Yeah,
and Cowper's.
they both ran last time. They both did better than I would have expected. And I think that was true across the board. Like Bradfield, I just sort of mentioned that it's taken over a part of North Sydney, but the electorate as previously constituted, Nicolette Bowler was the candidate there last time. And she, I don't think anyone was really looking at that seat last time. Everyone knew that there were six seats that, Teals could knock over Liberals. And not only did they win every one of those seats, they came surprisingly close in these other seats that no one had even looked at. Bradfield was one of those seats, and Wannon and Cowper, both of the candidates there ran last time. Both of them really did surprisingly well, and that was as part of the entire Teal phenomenon overperforming expectations.
And I think there's a fair bit of precedence for the Cowper area in Rob Oakeshott being an independent from that region before as well.
And yes, indeed. And it has always been the case, that country seats, I don't think there's ever been such a thing as a safe seat for the Nationals, because the country voters have always shown a willingness to rebel against when they think the wrong candidate has been pre-selected, when they think the National Party is too close to the Liberals and not standing up for regional interests enough. Country voters have always been willing to defect. Usually, they have defected towards sort of personalities who come out of the National Party orbit. This phenomenon is different. Like Rob Oakeshott came out of the National Party orbit. I think he was sort of perceived to have moved to the left over time and become a kind of Teal before his time in doing so. But in those sorts of seats, I think the complexion of them has changed a lot. People talk about sea changes and tree changes. These are coastal electorates, and they've got large urban centres in them. Wannon, you've got Warrnambool, Cowper, you've got Port Macquarie, you've got very large urban centres, which are, we're not talking about farmers here. So it isn't always the case that the National Party is a perfect fit for these sorts of quasi-urbanised regional seats.
Now, talking about the fate of the majors, William, with the polling we've seen seems to be floating around about 52-48 for the most recent polls. Correct me if I'm wrong, somewhere around about that. Now, we know all these seats go in different directions, and we just spoke about a dozen seats just then. What are the chances with 52-48 two-party preferred Labor for Labor to reform a majority government? Is it more likely, less likely? I mean, they've got a wafer-thin majority at the moment.
Well, you say, correct me if I'm wrong, I think arguably you are, because just an hour ago a poll came in from YouGov that had Labor ahead 53.5, 46.5, and this is a very good pollster.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Yes, and Roy Morgan doesn't have as good a reputation, but it had an extraordinarily big and frankly implausibly big Labor lead this week. There are 52-48 is almost looking at it's at the low end of what pollsters are saying at the moment. I'm skeptical about that. I will believe it when I see it. I'm happy to run with 52-48 as being the scenario we should talk about us looking at here, because there has been a certain tendency for Labor to underperform the polls, most famously in 2019. But like even in 2022, their primary vote was sort of nearly 3% lower than what most of the polls were saying at the end. And even at the Western Australian election, I think the pollsters did well there, but they all had Labor on about 44% of the primary vote and ended up being 41, 42. That sort of seems to happen so often that I think it does make sense to, lowball where Labor are coming in at the polling a little bit. And so while I could quibble with you saying 452-48 is what the polls are saying, I think it's what my instinct is as to where things really are. And that makes your broader question, is this, does it does are Labor in a position for majority government there? The right question to ask. And it puts them on the cusp. I don't think it's fundamentally different from last time when Labor got 52.1 and they, won, they got a majority with one seat to spare. So they could get lucky and win a few extra seats. They could get unlucky and win a couple of fewer seats. You just have to look at, where those seats are that could go either way. And if 52-48 is an accurate representation, then I think we're looking at the luck of the draw. I could say that incumbent governments tend to get a scrape over the line in these sorts of line ball seats. They've got the resources of government at their disposal. They've got, slush funds that they've squirreled away out of the budget to sweeten up voters with local initiatives that can garner that little bit of extra support exactly where they need it. So it wouldn't surprise me if Labor did hold on with 52-48, but when you actually start looking at seat scenarios, I think we're starting to talk about Labor winning seats that they weren't expected to win a couple of weeks ago. And that could be a whole different discussion of itself. But I think that is where we need to look. Are there seats Labor can actually gain from the coalition? And I can see maybe one or two. I still think that Labor are going to have a very difficult time holding all of their ground in Victoria. So I do expect that there will at least be a couple of Labor losses in Victoria. In terms of maintaining the majority, the answer is, are they picking up new seats elsewhere?
Yeah, I think you talked about Griffith as a definite opportunity in Brisbane.
Brisbane, I said, they could win. Griffith, I said, I thought the Greens would hold. Brisbane was the seat I thought Labor might win off the Greens.
So when that's one seat,
That is one
I
state which doesn't require the coalition to lose any skin. But I will be looking very closely at Sturt in Adelaide. That is the only seat that the Liberals have left in Adelaide. I think they are under big pressure there. There is an enormously popular Labor Premier in South Australia. And the indications of local polling is that with that, across the board increase to Labor of about 2 to 3% over the last couple of weeks, that has, so far as Adelaide's concerned, that's transformed it from a situation where Labor are trying to hold on to Boothby, their marginal seat in Adelaide. I think very few people expect Labor to lose that seat now. The game in Adelaide is, do they knock off that one last Liberal Party citadel in Adelaide? And I think they're a very good shot there. There was talk that maybe Labor could win the seat of Leichhardt in the far north Queensland. That's Warren Entsch is retiring. He has been the member, a very popular member there for an extraordinarily long time. He had a 3 year, what's the word I'm looking for? An interregnum in Queensland.
Hiatus. Hiatus.
The word will come to me when it's too late. He had a furlough. He had a, in 2007, he retired and Labor won that seat as part of Labor's sweep under Kevin Rudd at that election. Then at 22, he unretired and he added another 12 years to his parliamentary career. He's finally going now. No one doubts that that is a seat where he has a huge personal vote. Most of it is Cairns. So while it is a regional seat, it's a very urbanised regional seat to the extent that it's Cairns. And having said that, though, most of the kind of scuttlebutt there is that Labor won't quite make it. That it's still a, it's not an, it, Labor did not do well in that area at the state election. So you do struggle to see where Labor are going to make gains. Maybe I'm beyond those two seats that I've mentioned. Sturt and Brisbane, I'm not saying they can't make gains, but whatever seats they are going to be, if indeed they happen, will be a little bit of a surprise to me.
Probably one other one I'd throw in there is an outside chance. William, it might be more in Western
I
Australia.
thought of mentioning that, But I find it very hard to get over the hurdle in my mind that Labor can't possibly do any better in WA than they did last time. Having so my assessment of WA would be sort of a bit similar to what I just said of South Australia, that I sort of went into the campaign thinking, well, look, Labor aren't going to hold Tangney. That lightning's not going to strike twice. But now I think they're competitive in Tangney. More, we'll see. Like I said, I only went as far as saying I would be somewhat surprised. I think Labor are strong enough now, and the polling in WA is very strong for them at the moment, even stronger than they were in 2022. I just have to add to that the qualification that I find the polling just a little bit difficult to believe in how strong Labor are. Some of these sort of two parties we're seeing are better than Labor did under Rudd in 2007. They're, rivaling Hawke in 1983. Are they really doing that well? My intuition tells me that they're not. So I suspect Moore's going to be close with no cigar, but we'll see. Stranger things have happened.
So with all of that, William, give us a rough estimate on where you expect Labor to finish and the Liberals to finish with their seats come Saturday week.
Yeah, look, all I'm for, there is still a week is a long time in politics, it's, we've still got a week to go. We've had a week in which the pre-polls are only open for 3 days. So there could be a change of mood in the last minute. This does happen sometimes. And also, I think more likely the polls are overshooting a little bit with respect to Labor at the moment. So my feeling is that, Labor are going to land bang on half. It's going to be, are they a little bit behind? Are they a little bit ahead? They've got momentum. It could be that I'm underestimating them, that momentum's going to continue, and that I am altogether underestimating Labor. But my feeling is pretty early on election night, it's going to become apparent that Labor have been returned. The question we're going to be asking all night is, are they going to make it to the Magic 76?
It will be very, very interesting, I think. So I think we've had a fairly good assessment this time round. William, any surprises over the next week that you might be predicting? Anything out of the box?
Well, I mean, that you talk about an October surprise in the context of US presidential elections. That presupposes they have a whole month in which to happen. And I mean, the nature of a surprise is that you don't see them coming. And if anything happens between in the next week to really rock the dial, by definition, it's something I wouldn't care to predict what it might be. We will be talking about a black swan event. And most of the things I can think of are things that wouldn't do Labor any harm. Maybe Trump's going to do that's, if you want what's going to surprise us in the next week, I think the obvious answer to that is something Donald Trump might do. And it's difficult to see anything of that nature being anything other than favourable for Labor. Certainly, every other thing Donald Trump has done has been.
Well, we'll leave it on there with the president. I think he's full of surprises, so we can't predict anything, I think, with what's coming out of Trump's America at the moment. But it has played a role already, I think, on the
And
election
this is
campaign.
it's unusual for American politics to loom as large as it has. And
I think
that's
that has been one of the big surprises and of this federal election campaign,
Yes,
just
indeed.
the impact on global affairs.
Yes.
William, we'll leave it there. It's fantastic to have you join us.
My
Thanks for joining
pleasure.
us on View from the Roundhouse. And we'll look forward to more of your analysis during this upcoming election and post it.
Okay, till next time.